My name is Warren Zola, and I am the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the April 19th Forum, featuring David Cordani, Chairman and CEO of The Cigna Group. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, David Cordani, Chairman and CEO of The Cigna Group, engaged in a fireside chat with John Fish, Chairman and CEO of Suffolk. The conversation focused around the importance of health to an individual, a company, and a community, the concept of vitality, the importance of mental health, and the need to control healthcare costs.
It was noted American philosopher and poet, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who opined, "The first wealth is health. The first wealth is health." Now, I picture him sitting over at Walden Pond, just a couple miles from here, enjoying nature, thinking about life, and recognizing the importance of health, not only to oneself, but also to one's community. And it's that perspective where we're going to learn so much today from our keynote speaker and his host. So on behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to another Boston College Chief Executives Club. Now, we're thrilled to be here today, but we're especially thrilled because we have some very important guests who have joined us from across the pond, as they say, from Ireland. Over a decade ago, there was a vision to engage and enhance transatlantic business. Out of that concept came a football game in 2016, the Aer Lingus College Football Classic, where Boston College played Georgia Tech at Aviva Stadium in Dublin. It's been a while, so I don't recall who won the game. But it wasn't that funny. But I do remember and am so grateful for the relationships that it created. And since that time, over the ensuing 8 years, we have engaged what we call the Boston College Ireland Business Council, where we will get together twice a year, and every 6 months we'll either travel to Dublin or London once, or here in the States at Boston. And today is a special day, as we have 50 plus members of that group who have traveled from Ireland to join us here. They did spend some time in Atlanta, Georgia, in Austin, Texas, decided they missed their weather, so they brought the cold and rain yesterday with them. There are some rumors that while in Austin, Texas, there might have been an occasional Stetson hat and cowboy boots purchased. Their fearless leader, or one of them, Robin McGillifodrig, who apparently, rumor has it, and I've seen the video, engaged in some two-step line dancing. Now, his company named SkillStack, he has graciously agreed to come on stage after today's event and lead this as he continues to stack skills for his new enterprise. But candidly, we are so thrilled to have so many of you travel to join us today. Obviously, the heritage and mission of Boston College is so intertwined with the island of Ireland. We're thrilled to have you here today. And I hope that our members from Boston have an opportunity to engage, to network, to meet, and to reach out to me after today's event to figure out how you can join us as we head over to Ireland in October. We do have another event coming this spring on May 22nd. We will be welcoming and hosting David Solomon, the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs. He will be hosted by longtime friend, former keynote speaker, proud Boston College alum, the former chairman and CEO of Visa, Al Kelly. I also hope that you note we've got a calendar for our fall events that have already been confirmed, and we're very excited about them. This fall, we will be welcoming the CEOs of Lockheed Martin, McDonald's, Amgen, and Visa. Please grab a calendar out front. Mark those dates on your calendar. We are thrilled to have you attend in the future. Now, on to today's event. Our host for the day is John Fish, the chairman and CEO of Suffolk. And I could spend a lot of time talking about John's business accomplishments, but I also, more importantly, would like to mention his philanthropic and his board service in three areas: education, access to healthcare, and growing the economy. It is the access to healthcare that makes him the ideal candidate to be our host today to engage in a conversation with David Cordani. David serves as the chair and CEO of the Cigna Group. He joined the company in 1991, so he's starting to get the lay of the land, and has helped, under his leadership, grow that company to a Fortune 15 company with over 180 million customers and 70,000 employees. Now, he does have, and I'd like to connect everybody to Boston because we are the hub. He does have a nice connection to an event that was held on Monday this week here in the city, and part of his engagement with Achilles International Freedom Team of Wounded Veterans, where he has served as an aide, running the Boston Marathon four times, assisting veterans to traipse the 26.2 miles from Hopkinton to Boston. So for that, David, we are gratefully appreciative of your dedication and service. And the last number I'm going to leave you with is the number five, because five is the magic number. Five are the number of Boston College degrees that the children of the two men who will be coming on stage next have or will have in a couple of years. John is the proud parent of three daughters, each of whom has a degree from Boston College. I do have a personal favorite who took my class, who remain nameless for now. And David is the father of a current junior and an incoming freshman. At this point, I'm going to invite David to come on stage. He's going to provide a brief keynote address. He will then welcome John on stage for a fireside chat, and they will open it up for Q&A from the audience. Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, everyone. Please continue to enjoy your meal, and even though we're going to talk a little bit about health, enjoy your dessert as well, everything in moderation. We'll come back to that. I have to say, it was a little unnerving when it started, because I knew Warren was behind me, but I didn't realize by the seat, it felt like he was about 14 feet high and towering over me, so I had to get a little bit acclimated to that. It was a little overwhelming. If you give me maybe 10 minutes of your time, I want to cover a couple topics. Talk about Boston for a moment. Talk about the overall health situation across the globe and carry that back to the U.S. Talk a little bit about a measurement we see in terms of a comprehensive measure of health vitality, and then what it means to an individual, a community, or an organization. I'll try to do all that in 10 minutes or so. And then I look forward to the dialogue with John and then questions with you all. Back to Boston. I love Boston, simply. So any excuse to be back in Boston is powerful. I'm a lifelong Red Sox fan. Grew up watching the Red Sox with my grandfather. Grew up in my grandparents' house. So there's a lot of nostalgia back here. As Warren noted, we're blessed to have one child and soon to be two children going through Boston College. But also the memories of the marathon is referenced. And I'll just tie back to that, because there's a tie-in to the marathon as well. I remember, I think it was 15, the weather was nasty, but there was many marathons with nasty weather. Wind was out of the east, 30 degree weather, sleet, freezing rain, et cetera. And then running the marathon with a double amputee Army Ranger in terms of trudging through in service to try to safely get to the finish line. It's a starting line and a finish line and everywhere in between. And what stands out, there's a variety of things we could talk about, but one thing that stands out is the power of community, because even in the horrific weather that took place, the amount of community support in this great city from the starting line to the end is like nothing I've ever seen. And after 30 years of racing, mostly in the United States but elsewhere, the power of community and willing individuals to finish and the support is just palpable. And when we come back and talk about health, vitality as well, that happens symbolically like it happens along the running course. It happens symbolically in the aid stations, but it happens in work, it happens in your personal life, et cetera. And I was fortunate to come back year after year and be in service to a soldier and experience all that energy. I want to pivot across to the health situation across the globe. We're talking about this in the United States, but some of the trends are similar across the globe. Like it or not, the health status in America continues to erode or soften. Now, there's fundamental forces behind that, an aging of a population, and there's a graying that's transpiring around the world. But lifestyle and behavior have a heavy correlation. In fact, as validated through most sources, about 80% of all medical costs in the United States tie to a lifestyle or behavior. Drinking, alcohol, yes, no. If yes, in moderation, yes or no. Smoking, yes, no, that's binary. Physical activity, some or none. And then food intake in moderation or not. So we have a health status, but we also have a mental health challenge in the United States as well. One in every five individuals is confronting a mental health challenge. Yet we have an access challenge in terms of either not enough or a stigma relative to accessing. And we know that if physical health and mental health are being coordinated more effectively, medical health improves and overall mental health improves, as does physical productivity, personal productivity, and levels of engagement. This is not just a US phenomenon. It's similar in other OECD countries around the globe that we see some of the challenges. Now, there are bright spots, and we could talk about some of the bright spots through our conversation, but the bright spots typically require leadership at a company level, at a community level, at an organizational level, obviously at an individual level, and some peer support to come along with that. Let's shift gears and attach that to a theme of vitality. As a global health service company, we sought to be able to develop or design a significant comprehensive measure of overall health and well-being. In 2017, we fielded the largest body of work with independent researchers around loneliness and confirmed that there was a loneliness epidemic in our country. Fast forward to the present, we're now plus 2 years out of a vitality measure and a vitality index that could be measured at an individual level, at an employer level, at a city level, which I'll come back to in a couple of moments. You can measure it for a college, we can measure it for a country as we have. And we fielded it across the United States as well as 12 different countries. It's a comprehensive measure trying to understand overall vitality, what every one of us wants for our loved ones, a vital, complete, highly engaged life, measuring physical health, mental health, spiritual health, financial health, et cetera. What we learned from it is that in the United States, vitality is plateaued. It's fundamentally plateaued, and it's decelerated for some. What we were able to see with it is with high levels of vitality, take an employer as an example, an employer has higher productivity or engagement or performance. A community thrives if it has thriving employers and a thriving community. What do we all want? We want a thriving community. Take it back here in Boston. Boston's level of vitality is actually lower than one would expect. Lower than one would expect when you compare some of the underlying measures. Population on average younger than many cities, in part because of the wonderful college and university structure here. Income levels a bit higher. Education levels a bit higher. Levels of comorbidity a little lower. So oftentimes when you have an older population versus younger and higher comorbidity population versus less, the level of vitality moves up or down. But somehow in this marketplace, while those counterforces exist, the level of connectivity is a little bit more fragmented. Connectivity, as I've chatted with several of you before we started, is a powerful elixir relative to vitality. You know that in your personal life when we reflect on it. And it's connectivity like this. Oftentimes, it's not just connectivity like this in terms of being able to drive a level of vitality and thriving. So us as an organization, we don't do this to say we have all the answers. We do it as a means of guiding us to find the requisite level of answers for a company, for a community, for an organization, and importantly, work in partnership. And what I find very exciting about this gathering is the diversity of voices that you all represent. Because the diversity of voices that you all represent help this community be able to thrive, improve, maintain the status quo, or passively watch it erode. And what moves a community forward is the power of connectivity, just like where I started with the Boston Marathon. What propels that forward is the power of community to be able to drive it through. So in closing, this notion of vitality is not a novel concept. It's not a theoretical concept. It's a way in which to measure, because we believe that if we can improve human performance, you can improve organizational performance. When you improve an organization's performance, you improve a community's performance and vitality. And when you step back and look at the picture, it's a virtuous cycle. All three need one another. We know that. We know that. All three need one another. But when you inspect it at its core, it requires public-private partnership. It requires business care deliver partnership. It requires academic industry partnership to be able to drive it through. And as I noted, in the face of some of the challenges, there are plenty of bright spots. So in summary, we're an organization that wakes up every day trying to make a positive difference in people's lives. We're an organization that's entrusted to serve, whether in the United States, largely through corporations, health plans, and governmental entity partners that we serve, or outside the United States, taking care of expatriates through corporations, IGOs, NGOs, aid workers, and the like. But the commonality exists. How you improve the quality of life for an individual is, of course, absence of medical health needs, but it quickly takes you into the mental health needs and the overall level of engagement and community performance. With that, I look forward to a conversation. John, I'm going to welcome you to the stage, put myself in your hands, and look forward to engaging in a conversation.
Very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to begin by acknowledging our Irish friends, beautiful country of Ireland, Neil Nottingham. And I would just want to mention one thing about Neil that he didn't tell us, because we're here with BC teams. He's on the School of Mendoza, Business School at Notre Dame, on the other side of the table, so we won't hold that against you. Congratulations. I also want to thank Warren and his team. I think a lot of times we take this for granted, and he has done an amazing job assembling a wonderful group of CEOs that really care deeply about this community. So I'd just like to give Warren and the entire staff a round of applause. And one last comment is, chair of the board of Boston College, I just want to say with a sense of humility and appreciation, thank you for your support for joining us today. It means all the world for us at Boston College to be able to be the convener of these types of conversations that impact each and every one of us in our communities and our families as well. So again, thank you to yourself. David, I'd like to begin just by congratulating you. You know, obviously I did a little homework before we stepped on stage here.
Be careful what you read.
And it's just amazing the growth that Cigna's had over a period of time. And I'll talk a little bit more from a question point of view later on. But again, you know, top, you know, 15 Fortune 500 company in the country, which is an amazing feat. Largest company in Connecticut, and probably one of the strongest healthcare servicers, I think, in the world today. And again, congratulations to you and your entire organization. As you and I spoke, it's about a team. It's not about an individual. I also want to thank you for your support of Boston College. Your daughter and your son that's going to be matriculating this fall. It's wonderful to have you in the family, and we're honored and privileged. And thank you very much, and we wish you best of luck. I'd like to begin with a conversation around healthcare in the state of healthcare today. We all know here, being from Boston, that it's a constant conversation that comes up, not in a positive light. Whether it be healthcare costs, whether it be access, whether it be providers, you know, nurses, staffing shortages, it seems to mount. And we don't think here it's sustainable. And something has to be done, especially the governmental programs, Medicare, Medicaid. What would you say Cigna is currently doing to address these particular concerns? And as you specifically as a CEO, how do you feel about this on a going forward basis?
So maybe I'll start at the latter piece and work my way back. A way I think about how I feel about it as a CEO as I start, how I feel about it as a parent. If you go back in time, every generation's afforded the next generation a longer, healthier life expectancy. My generation, current course and speed, will fail that. So I start with that challenge every day, staring in the mirror in terms of how do we drive change and harness the innovative power that exists to improve overall quality of life. Stepping back, the US, I believe passionately, is the best sick care intervention system in the world. People travel from all over the world to come here. I was mentioning to some folks in terms of we've had expatriates that we bring in from all over the world to experience some of the services in this great city alone. But oftentimes we lose sight of the fact that there's four groups of individuals in a population at any given point in time, and I'll try to attach that back. There's those that have an acute healthcare situation, In a perfect world, we want them to get center of excellence, evidence-based care treatment in the best possible way. That's the best overall value. There's a chronic population, evidence-based care, optimize the quality of life. There's two other groups. We think there's one other group. There's the healthy, that oftentimes we say, thank God they're healthy because we're not spending that much money on them. We need the money to spend on the sick. There's another group, the healthy at risk. There's 25% of any population that's at risk at any given point in time, that if the risks go unmitigated, will be in a chronic or an acute state in the next 2 years. How do we understand and intervene and improve the quality of life? And John, to attach it back, what we think about intensely is A, taking information to help try to keep people healthy, identify the healthy at risk and lower the risks, and then get the evidence-based care, but also increasingly work to align incentives where incentives are misaligned. Because alignment creates powerful leverage, misalignment creates erosion or friction. Alignment of incentives means with the center of care, the center of excellence. Alignment of incentives means rewarding people for helping to keep people healthy in the first place, as opposed to just spending dollars when sickness interventions transpire. It's easier said than done, but when we see bright spots, the bright spots exist and when that continuum works for the acute, for the chronic, for the healthy, and for the healthy at risk. And it's working together. It's having intellectually honest, fact-based conversations, using information, aligning incentives, locking arms, trying to improve people's lives, and then sharing the benefit with everybody involved. The patient, the employer if they're financing, the healthcare professional, and then for our company, having a sustainable return, which is 4 to 5%.
I was at the Wall Street Dinner Council last evening in New York. It's hosted by Boston College on an annual basis. And Karen Lynch, the CEO of CVS was there, and she was our honoree, presidential award. And, you know, I mentioned to her that we were speaking today, and she said to me, you know, ask David about incentivized value-based care. And I know we've all heard about that, but at the end of the day, to me, that seems to what you pointed out to be really what we have to attain as a system. Because if you sit back and say to yourself, we spend $4.5 trillion a year, almost 17%, 18% of our GDP on healthcare. And I think a lot of us would argue we're not getting it right. So can you talk briefly about that? Sure. Incentive-based value care?
So value-based care, yeah, is a, first, our industry makes up acronyms every day, VBC. We do, we just manufacture acronyms. So value-based care, let me define what we see it as, because some people can convert it to mean that organizations like ours own physicians and then drive alignment through the ownership, and then through the ownership, do some revenue management. For us, it's not ownership. It's alignment of incentives, taking evidence-based care, understanding what the baseline measure is for a given patient population. It's having then incentive alignment that you pay more for higher quality, dynamic sharing of information, and importantly, in many cases, sharing clinical resources. Could be home healthcare professionals, could be behavioral health professionals. We operate one of the largest behavioral health organizations, both virtually as well as physically. In home care, we do in-home infusions, but it's aligning the incentives that work along the way to be able to generate better outcomes and working hand in glove. And those are some of the bright spots. The bright spots that exist are around value-based care, and I'll end with a tangible anecdote. We're even able to drive value-based care programs back with pharmaceutical manufacturers, which if you read the headlines would do this. They show butting of the heads. People need to step back and say, how do we generate alignment? So for some of the higher cost pharmaceuticals, you want the rewards to be paid based on the clinical outcomes, not just the consumption, and the continuity of care to generate the physical outcomes. So we work hand in glove with some pharmaceutical manufacturers on some of the higher cost interventions to identify the right patient, the care coordination, and to generate the outcomes. So it's outcome-based, not consumption-based. It's not this, it's this, locking arms. It's using incentive alignment, information, and care resources to try to generate the best possible outcome for a patient, but do it together, as opposed to too many people in our industry, in many industries you may have seen before, like to do this. That doesn't work. That doesn't work.
In the business world, I think we refer to that as a meritocracy, you know, at the end of the day. Speaking of that, I think we talked about cost of healthcare, not sustainable. We've talked about access. We've talked about staffing shortages. And we are going to talk about mental health. One of the big issues going on today is prescription drugs. And some of the different drugs that are out there right now, the cost of those drugs are almost unattainable for a lot of the populations exist. And one of the examples I'd like to talk about is a therapy being like $15,000, for a dose, so to speak. So what a chronic to deal with a chronic condition. And I know there's a thing called biosimilar that they're working on these different therapies that are similar to the drug, but they're generic in many respects. That's a term that I'm going to use. And one of the drugs when I was researching was Humira, which I wasn't familiar with. And apparently they had IP for almost 20 years, and they had no competition out there to deal with it. And they were able to charge the rates for people, and it was unaffordable for many, many categories of people. And can you comment a little bit on biosimilar manufacturing therapies? And where do you see that entering into our business today? And where do you see it in the next few years going forward?
Yeah, so back to just grounding a data, the U.S. lags the world in use of biosimilars. If the U.S. used the same amount of biosimilars per capita as the OECD countries, it would be about a $300 billion annual savings per year to be able to contribute for other aspects of care. So data point one, the good news is this is not on the kind of bleeding frontier. Other OECD countries have figured out how to drive some leverage here, point one. Point two, biosimilars come in with incentive alignment. So how do you get the incentive alignment to be able to utilize the biosimilars? And if you take Humira, now we have interchangeable biosimilars in the United States. There's more choice. You afford the choice. The brand manufacturer has lowered the pricing because of the biosimilars. And we are a company that believes in choice. So we offer our clients, whether it's a corporation, a health plan, a governmental entity, choice of the biosimilar versus not, and then work with the prescribing medical professional. As you go forward over the course of the next several years in the United States alone, there's about $100 billion more of biosimilars that will come online, and present additional choice. We see that as a net positive because it presents the opportunity to create additional capacity for other innovations that will come forward with not $15,000 drugs, $100,000 drugs, $1 million drugs, or a $4 million drug that was just approved for a specific purpose and use. So it presents a lot of opportunity. Last point I would note, it's not as simple as when we've lived through the brand generic oral consumption. Biosimilars are a little bit more complex. There's interchangeable, non-interchangeable, but the clinical coordination that needs to happen around the biosimilars needs to be quite coordinated. That's back to in partnership with the prescribing physician. Yeah. That is important. This is a bright spot for our country and an opportunity that over the next several years, we have to drive more biosimilar utilization. Not a negative to any manufacturer, more in terms of it's the natural innovation curve and it creates more capacity to be able to pay for some of the new interventions that are curative, in some cases life-saving.
Yeah. Guests like the CEO of Dana-Farber, Lori Glimcher, who's with us, Ann Klebanski, the CEO of Mass General Brigham, David Brown, the president of Mass General Brigham, then John Fernandes from Lifespan over here, and there might be other clinicians and researchers and administrators here today, but it's a fascinating conversation because I think that everybody's grappling right now. How do we contain cost or lower cost? With keeping in mind, it's all about keeping the patient first. Once you center on this conversation about doing what's in the best interest of the patient, you can never go wrong. The cost is a huge factor. I'm going to transition now to an issue that's near and dear to a lot of people, but it's not talked about that often. It's so important. It's near and dear to me is mental health, and I know it is to you. And especially, we've seen the raging amounts of mental health challenges post-COVID. And I often say that the worst of COVID is yet to be experienced. And I refer to that as mental health. When kids weren't going to school, okay, kids weren't going to college, the whole unintended consequences of what went on that phase. And all of us as parents are probably have an acute eye for that. And I know there's a lot trying to be done with the challenge of mental health. As I often say to my people, bring your problems to work. We all have issues, OCD, ADD. All our families have issues, every family. If you tell me you don't, I'm not going to believe you, end of the day. And that's very, very honest, okay? So why not bring your problems to work? You demonstrate a sense of caring and compassion. How do you look at this issue of mental health? And what can Cigna do, or what is Cigna doing about trying to educate and stem the tide of this considered to be a crisis here in America, and I would say in the world?
Yeah, I think the first, many of these topics are talking about, there's not an easy answer or a singular answer. So I appreciate you saying, how do we think about it? One, as we step back, I have a good memory, but I lose track of time. Probably 15 years ago or more, we were able to see that the mental health, physical health interdependency was significant. So as an example, we embedded mental health professionals in our coronary case management programs. Why? If an individual had a heart attack and survived, there was a high probability they're going to have depression in the recovery. Life changed. The data showed that if the depression went untreated, there was a higher probability of a second heart attack than if the depression went treated. Simple example. So bringing physical health and mental health programs together, and we've increasingly done that over time. Fast forward to the present state, one of the benefits, because I'm an optimist at heart of COVID, there's a lot of things that we could go on the other side of the ledger, is it destigmatized further mental health. Some people say, well, we've seen that there's a mental health problem. No, there's a mental health problem beforehand. It accelerated yet even further, but it destigmatized it a little further. And we now realize that there's stress, anxiety, depression, before we get further into the mental health and substance abuse challenges that come along. So one, how do we think about it? A, we don't put an artificial line between mind and body, right? You hear the terminology whole person. You have to make sure that line is pulled apart. And when a mental health professional talks about what's most important, a physical health professional, we need to bring them together. Two, expanding access. Expanding access is mission critical. So we've more than doubled our physical behavioral health access network over the recent past. Changing modalities. We have the largest virtual behavioral health resource access in America today. Third, we actually launched the Cigna Behavioral Group, where we're seeking to organize, not own, organize independent mental health professional practices that typically have one or two doctors or therapists, take the administrative burden off their desk, bring them new technology around scheduling, tracking outcomes, et cetera, to expand their ability to support their panel and help have better coordination of care that comes along. Those are examples of what we've been taking along the way to expand overall care access. An and piece, I would knock down on it, and I appreciate your comment of bring your problems to work. We are passionate supporters of the employer-sponsored system in America because employers have the ability to create a micro-community. Employers do create a micro-community. The question is, do you leverage a micro-community? Employers have peer support, peer pressure, communication infrastructure, incentive alignment, disincentive alignment, a lot of tools that can be brought to bear. We could see within employers who have active community giving programs and inclusion programs, the mental health burden is a little less challenging, right? Because the vitality is a bit higher. We see employers that say, bring your problems to work, right? The problems abate at a more accelerated level. They don't go away. Yet those problems are not cast across to coworkers as well. We see that employers who acknowledge the fact that it's not just the employee, it's their family unit that they're accountable for. And if there's an issue within a family unit, there's an issue with the employee. So we like the programs through those lenses. So reducing stigma, coordinating mental and physical, expanding access through the traditional level of network, challenging and acknowledging that technology brings on its own challenges of disconnection, using it as a modality of connection, and then helping mental health professionals being able to expand their reach from their practices by removing some of the burden are examples of what we're doing.
Thank you for that thoughtful answer. One comment I would make is both from a leadership point of view, which you all think about as CEOs, carrying the discussion, convening the discussion about mental health is leadership at the end of the day. And I think what's happened post-COVID, a lot of CEOs have begun to normalize that conversation in the workplace. And I think if it can be had at the workplace, I think the amount of progress we can make as a system, as a country, as a community is substantial at the end of the day. And I just, again, I applaud people having the confidence and the ability to have those type of conversations, because it's, I think, the one, number one agent out there that could really cause us a lot of problems if we don't really address it the way we're doing it right now. So I just want to say thank you for your leadership in that end. And David, what I would say is I know you're not an individual that would like to give yourself any type of accolades or you sort of stand on ceremony about your successes you've had, but you've had some tremendous successes, not just with your family, but with your business, both from a loyalty point of view, which we don't see that often, 1991 at Cigna, which is amazing, the growth of Cigna since 2009, okay, and you take a look at some of the stats, and again, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, doubled the stock value of the company. The current company right now is over a $200 billion revenue stream and a $100 billion market cap. That doesn't happen overnight, and that doesn't happen without leadership. And I know you don't want the credit, and you're going to tell me it's a team, but when I talk to some of your teammates, they tell me the example you set from a leadership point of view in this culture way, you said, is pretty, you know, inspirational. Talk to me about what you're more comfortable talking about, Cigna success. And then second, talk to me a little bit about how you do what you do, if you don't mind.
Hmm. How are you doing on time? Are you running out of time here?
I'm watching the clock.
So I appreciate your kind comments. We've had a significant amount of growth. The way we talk about growth in our company, growth means more lives to serve, more impact to have, more resources to invest in the virtuous cycle. We talk about it through that simple lens. So stepping back, in 2009, our company, which is 200 years of history, if you track back to the two founding organizations of Cigna, INA 1792, Connecticut General 1865, they came together in 1982. So there's a lot of longevity. But from 2000 to 2009, it had about zero growth. And growth essentially means that the market, those you serve, see value in what you do, ultimately. So we set off on a journey to answer your question. Point one is to try, and we still talk about it today, we want to prove the thesis every day that you could be a mission-based organization with values and cultural commitment that is also publicly traded, performance-based and growing. They are not in conflict and do not accept the false trade-off that they are in service of one another. And we seek to feed that every day knowing that we're not perfect. That guides us to have a vision and a direction in terms of we wake up every day to have a positive impact on people's lives. We then click that down to another level of being fact-based and sub-segment the markets because the problems we confront or the market opportunities are huge. You need to sub-segment and focus. Focus wins the day every day. Sub-segment and focus. Then relentlessly deconfigure and reconfigure ourselves, which is probably the most difficult thing to do, especially if you're having success. So the only data point you said, and I'm pretty proud, but our stock is more than 10x growth over the time.
Okay.
In terms of its growth, and I still think we're underperforming. Yeah. But it's how do you decompose yourself and recompose yourself because the market you serve continues to move at a rapid rate. And then from a leadership standpoint, I'm overhead. I say this internally. So I'm in service of others. My job is to be in service of others. Get the right strategy, have the right team, have the right alignment, have the right incentives, have the right measures. My job then is to get out of the way, but be willing to do anything necessary to support our team to be successful. And then it's that relentless pursuit. And like you said, you love what you do. I feel blessed to do what I do every day. But as I came back, we talk about those that we serve our own family members. We serve our neighbors. We serve our extended family members. So that drives us as well. And we feel fortunate to be in a space that's, the intent is so noble. Somehow we've made this market so complicated. But at the end of the day, as a human being with a set of needs and desires. So we try to work that through together. So for me, I just remind myself I'm fortunate. I grew up in a blue collar family. My brothers and I are first generation college. It's pretty simple. We actually didn't want to go to college. We argued with my parents. I wanted to work in a factory like all my cousins or be a cop like my dad was at the time. That was in Over My Dead Body. You're going to school, part of it. And then it's kind of in pursuit of this virtuous cycle each and every day and reminding yourself it's discretionary energy. And if you love what you do, it's not a job, right? You're fortunate.
A lot of people say that leadership comes from your upbringing. And that's why no one individual has the same characteristics of leadership. Whether you're born first gen or whether you're born in a poor environment or a tough neighborhood, those characteristics that you develop from a Darwinistic point of view sort of give you the sort of resources to tackle what your responsibilities are on a going forward basis. Would you comment on that a little bit and your upbringing and how that impacted your leadership style?
I reflect back on it because I like history because you can learn. So you reflect back. I boil it down pretty simply. My parents were married really young, like 17 and 19. So they moved in with my dad's parents. That was the Italian side of the family. We talked about the some half Italian. And I look back on the way we were raised, and my grandparents instilled in us. So I had two sets of parents in a way. They instilled in us, I boiled down to three things. Hard work. I'll start with that. And it's just ingrained in us. It's the notion of hard work, and we could talk about stories. The golden rule, when I boil it all down, so the person who empties the trash in my office, I know their name. because my mom did that job as a part-time job when I was vacuuming as a 12-year-old after school. And I watched when people in the office looked at my mom like she was a second-class citizen. So the golden rule, and then a sense of community and giving back. It was a pretty basic recipe. And when I think back about it, it served you pretty well. Because nothing we confront is easy, so hard work helps a lot. The golden rule tends to rule the day. Forget title or whatever. And then your sense of community and responsibility to give back and make a difference. And that works pretty well. It works quite well. And even go back to the Boston Marathon piece, you know, there are points where I remember running with one of the soldiers, and I had an injury, but I wanted to make sure I ran. And I was feeling a lot of pain, and I looked over at his prosthetics. I said, I can't feel pain now. That's not acceptable. Context, right? The context helps as well.
Yeah. Just one last comment I would make, talking about titles, you know, you're running a public company, I run a private company, and I'm very fortunate, own it myself.
Yes, you're very fortunate sometimes.
So I decided to give myself a new title about a month ago, and I had my cards printed out, and it's called CDW. And so I pass around to different people, and people say, what does that mean? It's Chief Dishwasher. So it works out very, very nicely in your lines.
I like that.
One last question, where do you see Cigna 5 years from now?
So there's not a succinct way I could answer that because we're on a journey. And when I think about the journey we're on, what I'd like to believe the environment that we are able to help to create 5 years from now, I'd like to see an environment where it is indisputable that the lives we have the ability to touch both directly and indirectly are materially better off from a vitality and a quality. Two, there's more coordination between the disparate parts of the ecosystem. Our ecosystem is too fragmented, and we see ourselves having to be a convener and enabler of that. And third, proving that the public-private partnership works. So what that all boils down to is in terms of, I'd like Cigna in 5 years to be the category-defining organization, because I don't think there's a category-defining organization. That's not at the loss of others, because we together need to create a new category around that. Because the payment of sick care has run its course. Necessary but not sufficient, right? The payment of perpetual sick care has run its course. Necessary but not sufficient. None of us want that for our family members or loved ones. We know it's necessary, but it's not complete. We need to complete that circle. And time's running out. The blessing there is, technological innovation and the speed of data helps to bring a lot more precision. Precision allows you to bring more personalization, more connectivity versus lack of connectivity, removing fragmentation, more pursuit of excellence in terms of, because the SME excellence that exists in healthcare requires more precision, and more connection of multiple modalities of interaction that have a seamlessness as opposed to a fragmentation. That's what I get excited about.
I would say this before I open to questions. The conversation here and your enthusiasm is contagious. And I want to thank you very much. I want to thank you very much for your leadership in healthcare. You've done a wonderful, wonderful job.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to now open up to our audience. We've heard a lot about leadership. We've heard a lot about healthcare. We've heard a lot about commitment and community and so forth. And I'd like to hear any here if you have any questions for David.
David, within an organization, how much of an impediment are the issues of privacy and liability to leadership, an impediment to leadership?
And before you give up the microphone, privacy as a means of information to be able to lead?
Yeah, but the reticence of the people in our organizations to come forward with issues.
Okay, thank you.
Right?
Yes. So, As I look at you come back to organizations, so any organization, but let's go to corporations for an illustration. If there is a dimension of inclusion and trust, it is a powerful, powerful tool. So some of the more sophisticated programs that are put in place, is when from the top, and to credit John, from the top, the feeling there is that there's a level of inclusion, togetherness, and trust to break down those barriers. If that doesn't exist, it's friction. It's another dimension of alignment. So to me, as I hear your question, that starts at the top of the C-suite. And if what we're talking about here is viewed as a on the side of the desk expense item that somebody else is managing, and I'm going to complain about how much of it costs, we're never going to like the outcome. If what we're talking about here is like any other strategic investment for an organization, corporation, governmental organization, university, a strategic investment that is looking for sustainable yield, then you have an opportunity. And if the culture of the organization has a level of transparency and trust, it's possible. Absent transparency and trust, we're pushing a rock uphill. You could accomplish it, you just need a lot of people pushing a rock uphill, and there'll be a lot more friction along the way. So when we interact with employers, I like to understand the culture, the strategy, the readiness to change, the tools and the modalities to drive change, the willingness to accept friction along the way. We just don't go in and say, here's the answer. You gotta understand the strategy, the culture, the health burden, the readiness to change, and each organization, like each being, has its own DNA attached around it.
Other questions? Yes, Rudy.
David, thanks so much for your innovative leadership. It's so appreciated. As we listen to you, one of the things that came to mind for me is our own community and the challenges that we face, as many urban areas face, when it comes to disparities in health. There's a study that Northeastern University produced subtitled, Two Stops on the Orange Line. Hmm. When you look at the health, the lifespan of those in Roxbury, primarily Black community, it's 59 years. Those in Back Bay could be as high as 92 years. How do we come together from a corporate perspective, nonprofit perspective, and government perspective to ensure those disparities are addressed?
Yeah, not a silver bullet answer, but I'll give you some thoughts. And we think about this daily, regularly, and continue to test and evolve as an organization. One, at its core, we believe all healthcare is personal and all healthcare is local. So you start with that. It guides us to the core of what you just said, because you have to get ultra localized and ultra personalized to understand it. Second, oftentimes when it comes to healthcare, we think about it from the, I'll call it, largest sick care intervention ecosystem and working our way back. We don't think about working from the community up. Example, during COVID, during the early onset of COVID, we would be on the phone every either 24 or 36 hours with the government and a bunch of stakeholders going through where certain aspects of the interventions were rolling out and the social determinants of health, the inequities, the imbalance, et cetera. So we decided to stop talking about it and go directly in market. So we picked three markets, Houston, Memphis, South Florida. And we went in community, we brought virtual resources in, we brought physical resources in. We found the ability to activate faith leadership was so powerful, so powerful. We don't think about faith leadership in the healthcare equation. We don't think about that as a mechanism. What an influence power. We had to step into, even when we're dealing with the COVID vaccines, the impediments for certain, including the Black community relative to inoculations. And when we activated the faith community, we were able to step through first flu vaccines as a gateway to COVID vaccines. We were able to extend mammographies, another aspect where there was massive imbalance of access. So my illustration is you start with a philosophy that none of this gets solved in terms of a general national or state of Massachusetts or Boston solution. It gets solved in communities, micro communities. I'm a passionate believer in micro communities, and you have to identify what the micro community is and the work from the community up as opposed to work from the center back down. You lever the center, but you work from the community up. And we have other bright spots, like in the south side of Chicago right now. which people can't safely navigate the streets. So we have to actually figure out a way to create safe corridors. You know who's helping us create the safe corridors? Grandmoms and aunts. They're pretty badass. Like, people fear them at times, right? But you learn it on the ground and work your way up. So as an organization, we're trying to drive with our value-based care programs we talked about, social determinants of health. Clinical programs we're driving with the National Diabetes Initiative, not for Cigna lives, but for lives. Community programs that we're driving through with our foundation, our volunteerism program. But I passionately believe it starts micro locally and works its way up. It doesn't start nationally and work its way down.
Can we take one more question? Just Dr. Glimcher.
Down in the front.
Thank you very much. That was really a wonderful presentation.
Very kind.
I just wanted to take a look at the future. What's going to happen in the future? We're going to all live longer. And what does that mean? That means that there are at least two diseases that are greatly going to increase our cost. One of them is cancer. As you know, we're going to have an increase of 77% of cancer patients by 2050. And then even more scary is Alzheimer's disease. One out of every three people who are over the age of 85 will have Alzheimer's. So we do need to recognize how important the academic medical hospitals are, because we do both research and take care of patients. And academic medical centers are more costly, although we have reduced our cost at Dana-Farber. So when you look at the future with those two, you know, big problems, what do you see is going to happen really when we, because we're spending $250 billion already for Alzheimer's disease, and that's just to take care of them. So what's going to be in the future? How are we going to? This is why academic medical centers are important, because we do make those discoveries. Over half of the new cancer drugs over the last decade come from Dana-Farber. So we need to keep that. It's a little more expensive, but I think it's what's critical is to keep the clinical part as much as we can out to satellites, which are less expensive. And that's what we're doing, and trying to reduce the number of inpatient people that need to go inpatient as compared to ones that don't need that. So if you look in the future, what are we going to do about Alzheimer's and increase in cancer, and yet at the same time keep our costs low?
It's actually a great kind of question and pause for all of us, right? This to lean into. I feel very fortunate when John asked the question earlier. He asked me in 5 years. Now you just took it out to 2050. So thank you. So let's step back, reiterate a couple points that I think we discussed and were raised. First, a background point. Again, I lose track of time. I'm blessed with a pretty good memory, but I lose track of time. If anybody has ever heard of the Dartmouth Atlas, the Dartmouth Atlas was done to document what happens in the United States in the last 6 months of life in terms of care consumption, and what are the outcomes. Folks who go back and do a little reading on it for 15, 20 minutes, it's not good. We lead the world in terms of spending and care consumption in the last 6 months of life with non-discernible outcome differences in terms of longevity or quality of life. I raise that because embedded in your question was having the right access to care and affordability and services at the right time, and we need to understand it. In fact, the Dartmouth Atlas went so far to say where there's more supply of care, there's more consumption of care versus less supply of care versus consumption of care. Now let me back up to the core. I think as I heard you ask the question and make the statements, in part was part of the answer is we all need to be, and I say we, you, our organization, Sarah, to your right, across the table, the pharmaceutical manufacturers, relentlessly aligned and oriented around identifying and generating more efficiency to create more capacity to pay for and provide access. So that might mean moving services from inpatient to outpatient, outpatient to freestanding, freestanding to physician's office to home, or home to virtual. Those are mechanisms of moving care to create more capacity along the way. It means more precision relative to center of excellence utilization, where under certain diagnoses, the centers of excellence exist. It means in certain ways, being able to see the risk of cancer before the cancer diagnosis manifests itself. If you all haven't seen the headlines, cancer is starting to onset at a very young age in our country at an alarming rate that no one could correlate back to. There are lifestyles and behaviors that have high correlation to certain onsets of cancer. If we allow it to continue on its current course and speed, I fear that we will all be knowingly or unknowingly living in the I Love Lucy candy episode. We know the conveyor belt is continuing to move faster, and we are watching it and not doing something different. So the optimistic part of my brain says the awareness of what you just said is growing. Information is becoming much more precise as I talk with organizations relative to the level of precision. David, you and I were even talking about pieces of it, the level of precision relative to driving improvement, value-based care in the pharmaceutical side of the equation of paying for outcomes, not just consumption, are going to have to continue to move on a more accelerated basis to create capacity as we go forward. Because I agree with you, as we live longer, the risk of what you just articulated grows meaningfully, meaningfully. And at least in this society, the U.S. society, over-rationing of care is not our norm. In the other OECD countries, it is. In the U.S. to date, it is not. And so long as we do not want that to be the norm, we're going to have to use the U.S. ingenuity around efficiency and innovation, I believe, to drive forward. So I end on that with optimism. I'm optimistic that the use of information, the movement to get more alignment, the realization that some of what we've done in the past, while noble, isn't necessarily going to work in the next 5 years, let alone 30 years, as we drive forward. And so long as we have an environment of continuous improvement that the U.S. has largely had in mostly every ecosystem in our country, we'll put ourselves in a better position. Not perfect, but in a better position as we go forward.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring David Cordani, Chairman and CEO of the Cigna Group. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.